This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Weather has become destabilized around the world as we approach the 1.5 degree C global average warming. 30,000 experts, policy people, and diplomats are in Poland planning for the next round of international climate talks. They are pushed by a wave of new science warning 2 degrees is too far beyond safe. Talk of desperate measures to cool planet Earth is coming out of the closet. A series of new papers, assessments of risk, and the way forward were just released by the Royal Society in Britain. We'll talk with the lead editor, Dan Mitchell. Then it's environmental lawyer Robert Verchik asking, who pays for the warming made by the West when it wrecks countries far away from this fossil-powered miracle of modern civilization? How much is a country worth when it sinks forever below the seas? Where will millions and millions of climate refugees go? It's talk at the highest levels right here on Radio EcoShock. Scientists like James Hansen have warned the Paris safe limit of 2 degrees C is not safe at all. The Royal Society just published 20 scientific papers investigating the differences between 1.5 degree warming and 2 degrees. They find that extra half degree could have extreme consequences on everything from the economy to weather. To prevent that last half degree warming, the project also includes studies of low emissions grids, carbon capture and storage, and even solar geoengineering, blocking the sun. The editor for this project is Dr. Dan Mitchell from the School of Geographical Sciences at the University of Bristol, UK. Dan is also the coordinator for the HAPPI project, HAPPI, which stands for Half a Degree Additional Warming, Prognosis, and Projected Impacts. Considering the Paris Climate Accord still accepts a limit of 2 degrees C warming with 1.5 as an option, the difference is information we all need to know before it is too late. Dan Mitchell, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, nice to be here.
So, Dan, why does a mere half degree of warming warrant so much work from so many scientists?
Well, as scientists, we often look towards our politicians for the questions that they're really keen for us to address, because these might have large impacts on, say, a country's economy or the way it operates. So most of the time, we just deal with questions that we find scientifically interesting. This particular question on half a degree additional warming, for us, is very interesting because not only is it scientifically important, but our politicians are also asking us this question. So those two things together have meant that we were sort of very keen to look into the problem.
As I mentioned, Dr. James Hansen, formerly chief scientist at NASA, criticized the Paris Accord, warning 2 degrees of warming is not safe and not a viable goal for humanity. In general, Dan, what does this new group of studies say about that?
Well, you know, I think we have to be slightly careful when we say sort of 2 degrees is not safe. Previous to the Paris Agreement, there'd been very little work done on what 2 degrees would do to the climate system, and even less work on what 1.5 degrees would do. Most of our previous work was looking at sort of 3, 4, 5 degrees of globally average warming. So it's hard to sort of jump to those statements without doing the thorough analysis. So I guess our papers have showed that 2 degrees, we can detect the climate change impact on human systems. So, for instance, health systems through extreme heat waves, or agricultural systems through changes in flooding and things like that. So, yes, we have detected a climate change signal, which is detrimental at 2 degrees. But likewise, any climate change can be detrimental. So even at 1.5 degrees, we still see some problems with the climate system. The key point here is the less we can warm the planet, the better off we'll be.
It's a bit confusing to me how the Paris Climate Accord came up with two numbers, 1.5 or 2. Can you tell us sort of how that developed?
Yes, so often these numbers used are more political than scientifically based. There's nothing magic which happens at 2 degrees, which doesn't happen at 1.9 degrees, say. They're just sort of convenient numbers where we expect we can avoid a lot of the impacts of climate change. So they're sort of rounded to the nearest half a degree, say. The 1.5 degree number was quite specific because it does retain to a lot of island flooding. So low-lying small island states may well lose a lot of their coastal lands between 1.5 and 2 degrees, which is why they were pushing in particular to get this 1.5 degree limit in the Paris Agreement so that they could sort of, make some statements about how their islands would be sort of beneficial for that.
Dan, who called for and funded this large project you worked on the impacts of that last half degree of warming, as published in the Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society?
Well, there were a number of different funders who funded the papers within the Royal Society issue. The papers I was involved with were funded by a UK research council called NERC, that's the Natural Environment Research Council. But different lead authors from around the world would have been funded through different organizations.
But was there a particular body that called for this study or organized it?
This particular set of papers, we as scientists decided to do it in conjunction with the Royal Society in the UK. But we did it because of the IPCC special report, which is coming out. And the IPCC is the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. So they are sort of the largest climate change body in the world. And they put these sort of regular reports together. So our special issue is sort of to help inform on that report.
I know that scientists don't want to be alarmists, that there's a caution built into scientists. But I have to say, I've interviewed many, and our climate situation looks alarming to me, and so are some of the paper titles in this new series talking about, for example, uncertainty, urgency, and the last gamble possible. Is it really serious what we're talking about?
Well, the main problem with climate change is, and specifically with carbon dioxide, which is the main greenhouse gas that we talk about, is that once it's in the atmosphere, it's very hard for it to go away. So carbon dioxide can stay in the atmosphere for thousands of years, which means sort of if we're not quite sure, what a certain impact of increased temperatures will be, it's much safer just to decide not to put carbon dioxide in there, because then we don't have to wait for 1,000 years to sort of see what our mistake might be. There are alternatives. We can take carbon directly out of the atmosphere, but we can't do that on a scale which makes any sense for the climate change problem, both politically or economically.
In a recent Radio EcoShock program, we heard from Chandra Bhushan. He's from the Center for Science and Environment in Delhi. He said that they have calculated for 9 months of the year, India is already at the 1.5-degree warming mark, and over 2 degrees for 2 months last year. Considering that more heat is still hidden by global dimming, I'm wondering, is it already too late to aim for 1.5 degrees of warming?
I don't think it's too late. I mean, with India in regard, India has been warming a lot more than many other regions in the globe. And the land surface has definitely been warming more than the oceans. So it's not surprising that we have these regions of, say, India, which have been higher than 1.5 degrees, certainly in the very high northern latitudes, for instance, over the Arctic, but also in certain parts of Africa. They've also warmed more than 1.5 degrees. But that's a very different question to the globe warming more than 1.5 degrees, because that's a huge amount of warming that needs to go on, you consider the size of the globe. It doesn't surprise me that these regions have warmed more I don't think that really has much of a bearing on if we can achieve the actual Paris goals.
Good. Well, suppose, though, that we reach a warming of 1.5 degrees C over pre-industrial levels at a global mean, and maybe some crops fail and drought or extreme weather become too costly for our economies. If it becomes obvious that 2 degrees is untenable, what would be the remaining options as considered in these new papers?
The most likely option, and the one that most scientists would favor, would be to do something called carbon capture and storage. So that is directly taking out carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and storing it somewhere else. The problem is that costs money, so we have to decide who pays for that. And in that sense, we might introduce something like a carbon tax. And all a carbon tax is a tax levied on the carbon contents of fuels. So that just means if you're going to burn X cubic meters of carbon-emitting fuel, you'd have to pay a certain amount of money. And then we can use that money to invest in technologies to take the carbon out of the atmosphere. So that could be one way. A more controversial way, of course, is talking about these geoengineering strategies. And by geoengineering, I mean changing the atmosphere in some way to cool the Earth's surface. Now, there's very few scientists who actually advocate for doing this, but there are scientists who advocate for research into this as a very last resort. And so two of the papers in our special issue talk about the ethical implications of that and what the sort of climate consequences might be of that.
Okay, now one of those papers is titled Solar Geoengineering as Part of an Overall Strategy for Meeting the 1.5 Degrees C Paris Target. The lead author is Douglas G. McMartin from Cornell and Caltech. What sort of technology is envisioned here?
Well, there's a number of technologies that they talk about in that particular paper. The main one they're proposing is something called stratospheric sulfate aerosol injection. Now, to sort of break that down as to what it means, all it means is that they would put in very fine particles up in the stratosphere layer of the atmosphere. So the stratosphere is about 10 kilometers high and extends to about 50 kilometers high. And it's well known to the sort of public as the region where we have the ozone layer, for instance. But when we have huge volcanic eruptions, dust from those eruptions and sulfate aerosol from those eruptions travel up to the stratosphere and they get trapped up there. And what we see during those huge volcanic eruptions is that the dust reflects incoming sunlight. And therefore, we don't get as much sunlight at the surface, so it cools the surface of our planet. And that's essentially all these geoengineering methods are saying, is we would mimic a large volcanic eruption by putting these aerosols into the stratosphere, thereby stopping so much solar energy getting to the surface. Now, that doesn't mean, you know, if we're currently in a 1 degree world, so our current climate is 1 degree warmer than pre-industrial levels. If we were to say go to a 2 degree world, and then we geoengineered back down to a 1 degree world, we wouldn't get exactly the same climate as we get now, and that's because the Earth system is very complex, and that's the real issue with geoengineering: is that it's not entirely obvious that if we geoengineered to the same temperature, we'd actually get the same climate. So that's where the research is in that particular paper.
Right, and the main concern voiced by many is that solar geoengineering may have unexpected consequences by altering cloud formation and or precipitation. What do the authors of this paper say about that?
Well, the authors of this paper and the other geoengineering paper sort of say this is, you know, by far the largest concern of their papers, and this is why they're not advocating for doing geoengineering. One of the papers does propose that if we were to do it, you do it in a very small amount to start with, and you would just see what happened. But you'd have to test this over sort of decades and then look at things like the impact of the aerosol falling out of the stratosphere, for instance, on precipitation.
Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to Radio EcoShock. Can the world afford to reach 2 degrees of warming as agreed at the Paris Climate Summit? Not according to a series of new papers published by the prestigious Royal Society. We're speaking to a leader in that big project, Dr. Dan Mitchell from the University of Bristol. Dan, please talk to us about some of the large impacts expected in a world 2 degrees warmer, the level accepted by world leaders signing that Paris Accord just about 2 years ago.
So the impacts on the Earth system are very varied. So for instance, for storms in the North Atlantic, it's hard to see too much of a change in those sort of things, the 2 degree world. For hurricanes in the Atlantic, for instance, it's hard to see change in, say, where those hurricanes will go. But globally, changes in hurricane frequency may come about at 2 degrees. And so we may get more Category 4 and 5 hurricanes, not necessarily in the Atlantic basin, but sort of in various basins around the world averaged together. In terms of extreme weather, there's quite a clear signal in heat waves and cold snaps. That's increased number of heat waves and decreased number of cold snaps. But things like the precipitation response, so flooding and droughts, that's a lot more varied, and it's a lot harder to tell the responses around the world for those. Certain regions, like the Middle East, it's quite a clear signal that they will get hotter and drier, which is, of course, particularly important for that region where there's a lot of sort of stressed tensions anyway. So the pitch is not looking great.
Well, what about one of your interests, Dan, the health impacts of a warming world?
Yeah, so climate change and health is sort of quite strongly linked on a number of ways. My work has focused a lot on the extreme heat and the extreme cold, and there's a very clear signal in both of those that if the population of the world stayed the same, we would see increased heat-related deaths and decreased cold-related deaths. However, the population of the world's not going to stay the same. It's going to increase. More people are going to move into cities. Cities retain heat. So there's going to be an even stronger signal there. There'll be certainly a higher proportion of our population will be the elderly generation as we sort of more able to care for the elderly. And therefore, we're going to see sort of very strong changes in the number of deaths in the future, which is something we need to sort of prepare for. Outside of the sort of extreme heat and cold, there are other health concerns with the Paris Agreement, changes in vector-borne diseases such as malaria and dengue fever. Those, it's less clear that the climate change problem is really going to be an issue because there are such good medical interventions at the moment, so anti-malarials and the like. So we concentrate a lot on the sort of extreme heat side of things, but there are other issues, and I don't have time to go into all of them, but disease from flooding, for instance, is another sort of issue.
Right. It's a huge subject on its own. And I know on another topic that you were awarded an independent research fellowship by the UK's Natural Environment Research Council to, quote, study the link between the stratosphere and extreme weather at the surface. That's a fascinating topic. And three questions come to my mind. And the first is, can climate change or greenhouse gas emissions or any other human factor change the stratosphere?
Yes, that's a really good question, actually. They do change the stratosphere. In fact, greenhouse gases in carbon dioxide in particular changes the stratosphere in a fascinating way, and it's much stronger than the change we see at the surface. So at the surface, we've seen about 1 degree of warming so far. In the stratosphere, the change is nearly an order of magnitude larger, so 10 degrees. The interesting thing about the stratosphere is that instead of globally average warming, we actually get globally average cooling. And that's exactly what we expect from the theory of climate change. So this was actually even predicted before we observed climate change. We predicted that carbon dioxide would have to warm the troposphere and cool the stratosphere. And that's one of our sort of strongest bits of evidence for human-induced climate change, is that actually we get that really strong dipole pattern. So there is a very strong climate change signal in the stratosphere. But to sort of extend on that with your second part of your question, does that matter for the surface? Well, it's a very active area of research, and it looks as if that climate change signal is not translating into anything too major for the surface. It's more to do with the natural variability of the stratosphere, which can cause some particularly extreme weather, especially for Europe and Northern America and Canada.
Is that related to the polar vortex?
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah, so the polar vortex, I guess it's more well known to the general public as the sort of region where we have the ozone hole. So we have a polar vortex in the northern and the southern hemisphere, and it turns out that the ozone hole is much bigger in the southern hemisphere, although there is an ozone hole in the northern hemisphere. But this polar vortex can be disturbed, so it can get broken down from time to time. And so actually only a month ago, here in Europe, we experienced some very cold weather, a lot of snow, and that was because the polar vortex broke down and it changed the circulation down in the troposphere. So it's those sort of extreme cold weather events which are really important. And you often see a very strong link between Canada, especially sort of Hudson Bay area, and Europe when these things happen.
Can you describe a couple of other papers in this study series that you think our listeners should really know about?
In terms of the Royal Society issue?
Yes.
So one of the interesting questions is, if you're a government, you have to make a decision if it's going to cost us X trillion of dollars to prevent half a degree of warming, but it's only going to cause half of that cost in impact damages. Should you really stabilize climate at the lower limit? Because it's going to cost a lot more. Now, there's one paper which deals with the economics of climate change. It's the Prates et al. Paper, and that discusses some of those issues in detail. So that's an important one to look at. Another important one comes out of our colleagues from the institute called ETH, and they look at the impact of the land surface on globally average temperature. So most of the papers look at how changing carbon dioxide can increase global warming to half a degree. Their paper looks at how if you just change the land type, so if you went from a forested area to a non-forested area, how big a globally average temperature can you get? And they find that you can get half a degree globally average temperature just from changing the land surface type, not changing the greenhouse gases at all. So that's, another important implication.
So, Dan Mitchell, we have this assessment now that 2 degrees of warming may not be tenable and the Paris Agreement may need some changes. So what happens now? Is there a next step where this science can get turned into international public policy?
Well, that's the real challenge. In the IPCC report that I mentioned, which is the sort of large intergovernmental report, will give some recommendations as to how dangerous 2 degrees is compared to 1.5 degrees. I think it's a little bit early to say that, you know, at 2 degrees we're doomed and at 1.5 degrees we're not. That's not what our report's saying. And I'm pretty sure that's not what the IPCC report will say. What we need to do is weigh up the balances of the change in probability of detrimental impacts at 2 degrees and 1.5 degrees, weigh up the economic costs, the social costs, and then sort of make a decision there as to how best to proceed.
But the hole in the plan is covered in the last paper in this series by Robert Verchik, where he says, quote, even assuming a heroic rush towards carbon reduction and adaptation, some regions of the world will be hammered hard by climate impacts, and there's supposed to be a loss and damage plan to help compensate those who get hit by climate but didn't really cause it and don't have the resources to deal with it. But I think this is where scientists and economists and the rest of us worry the whole thing's going to fall through and that we're not really going to help the other people who need it.
Yeah, I mean, there's big concerns there, and you summed it up nicely. But you know, what they're saying is there are countries, certainly in Africa as well as elsewhere, where there's going to be very strong impacts of climate change. East Africa, the Horn of Africa, is a natural example. Places like Somalia, in Kenya, in Ethiopia. And it is very unfair that these were not the people who caused climate change. It was the developed world. We had our industrial revolutions, and, you know, the UK is more to blame than most for that. And now we're sort of asking these other countries not to have their own industrial revolutions because it's going to harm the atmosphere. So there needs to be something put in place to say, okay, you need to be compensated for the fact that you can't have the same technological push as our countries did. And you also need to be compensated for the fact that we've caused this climate change and you're the one feeling the consequences. They're very, very tricky negotiations, as I'm sure you can imagine. And that's a very active area of research where I think we'll see more and more papers coming out. But certain countries like Bangladesh are really leading the way there. They set up a really nice loss and damage fund, which is used as a sort of preventative measure more than a compensation measure, in the sense that they use it to help forecast early warning for, say, crop failure. And then they can use that fund to help farmers change their crops or help them get the information they need to plant it at a different time. So that's where that sort of funding will be very useful.
We have been discussing a round of 20 scientific papers published by the Royal Society. They are in a special May 2018 theme issue titled The Paris Agreement, Understanding the Physical and Social Challenges for a Warming World of 1.5 degrees C above pre-industrial levels. The papers are open text. They're available free to the public. You can take a look for yourself. We've been speaking with the editor and author of the introduction paper, Dr. Dan Mitchell from the University of Bristol, UK. He is also coordinator of the HAPI Project, Half a Degree Additional Warming, Prognosis and Projected Impacts. You can find links to all of this in my show blog, published Wednesdays at ecoshock.org. Dan Mitchell, thank you so much for helping us out on Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me. It was nice talking to you.
I'm Alex Smith reporting.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. When extreme storms, fires, or crop failures devastate the poorest people in the world, will anybody save them? The richest countries polluted the atmosphere with climate-changing gases. Who will pay how much, for what, and how? Since hardly anyone in public media is talking about this, we will. A series of papers published by the Royal Society in early April 2018 showed the 2-degree guardrail for global warming is not safe at all. The project ends with a research article titled, Can Loss and Damage Carry the Load? The author is Robert Verchik. He is the Gauthier St. Martin Chair in Environmental Law at Loyola University in New Orleans. But Dr. Verchik is on loan to Yale as a visiting professor to the Yale Law School. Professor Verchik, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks.
You begin your article for the Royal Society with these words. I quote, "Even assuming a heroic rush towards carbon reduction and adaptation, some regions of the world will be hammered hard by climate impacts." So, Rob, when world leaders know climate change is now unavoidable, what is the forum where these issues of climate equity are being discussed?
They're being discussed with the UN at the UN Framework for Climate Change. And currently, this has to do, this involves countries that are all signatories of the Paris Agreement and that are all members of the Convention Framework on Climate Change. The U.S. is a member of the Convention Framework, but as you know, the Trump administration has announced that it would like the United States to withdraw from the Paris Agreement.
To get further with this discussion, we need to know how you define the term loss and damage.
Sure. Loss and damage is a phrase that was developed by the international community under the Climate Change Convention. And it is a phrase that basically refers to what I will call the leftover risk of catastrophe that occurs after we have reduced greenhouse gases as much as we can, and after we have helped countries adapt to storms and temperatures and so on. So if I could say it this way, there are three categories we might think of. One is a category of greenhouse gas reduction, and that is about avoiding climate impacts that we can't manage. Then there's a category called adaptation, which is about managing impacts that are inevitable, that is, impacts that we can't avoid. And now we are starting to realize that we are going to have climate change impacts that, A, we cannot avoid, and that, B, we will not be able to manage. And those kinds of catastrophic impacts are described by this phrase in the international community that's known as loss and damage. It's basically the leftover losses and damage after you've tried to reduce greenhouse gases and after you've tried to adapt and cope with them.
Should we call people who lose their homes, crops, or even their island nations victims? Is there a better term than that?
Well, that itself is up to a lot of debate. So it is true that many people who are going to be very catastrophically affected, particularly in island nations or in developing countries, these are people who are at very high risk and whose countries have done proportionately little in many cases to have contributed to the problem. So in the sense that they are being hurt by climate change, losing their property, sometimes their livelihoods, and being exposed to health risk, you can certainly say that they're victims. They're victims of other countries that have built their economies and increased their wealth by emitting greenhouse gases and then leaving it to others who can't afford it to essentially shoulder the burden.
I just wish there was another word for it, though. However, has any money been set aside already to compensate victims of climate change? And if so, how much?
Well, money has been set aside through the international processes with the UN to be transferred in many cases to developing countries. The purpose of that money is slightly different than compensation. So, for instance, through the Paris Agreement, for instance, richer countries promised to provide $100 billion by 2020 as a minimum amount of money that would then be transferred to developing countries. And this money would be used to reduce greenhouse gases, that is, that they would be used to modernize electric grids, to develop no-carbon sources of electricity. Some of that money is also designed to help countries adapt, which means, let's say, building seawalls or improving city plans so that residential areas don't get flooded, that sort of thing. The richer countries, that is, that the developed world, the industrialized world, has so far backed away from any talk of what they call the C word, compensation, because that implies that the industrial world did something wrong and that it owes something to the rest of the world that it's harming. And those are legal terms that so far the United States, the European Union, and other parts of the developed world, they have avoided that kind of a discussion. The poorer countries very much want a discussion about compensation, and they see this as a right, that is, as a right to be made whole from decisions that were destructive, that were made by others.
I'd like to discuss some of the five possible tools you raise in your article, and the first is insurance. What does climate insurance look like?
Well, climate insurance in some ways is like any other kind of insurance that's based on the variability of weather or other sorts of climate-related effects. I think that in the international community, what we're talking about are things like regimes for crop insurance that would prevent or at least make farmers whole after there had been, let's say, a devastating drought or some kind of blight on crops. It could also be a kind of weather insurance where a country could, for instance, take out a policy in which it would be compensated a certain amount of money if there were a certain storm of a certain size that came to the city in a given year. You know, it would be a kind of thing like that. So it could be a weather-related, it could be crop-related, flood-related, anything like that. There's a problem, though, with insurance markets and climate change. And the problem is that in a world without climate change, insurers over the years have been able to essentially figure out how much risk that they can take on in any given year because they use the past years as a reference. And so if you look at enough past years, you can say, well, there will be, you know, there's this chance of a storm, there's this chance of a flood, there's this chance of a heat wave. With climate change, all bets are off because we can't use past events to tell us about what we can expect in the future. And so it's possible that insurance companies won't be able to adequately price, if you will, the risk in the future. And it's also possible that if you're talking about a drought and climate change where the temperatures rise, you know, let's say 2 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels, you could have situations where you have multiple droughts in a single season throughout the world. And if that's the case, the insurers might go broke. They might have too many payouts in a given year. And that would lead to a fracturing of the system.
Oh, well, it might go bankrupt.
That's right.
Yeah. So another tool for after-the-fact climate compensation, if you want to call it that, might be relocation assistance. What is envisioned there?
We are at the very beginning of talking about relocation and different kinds of climate migration. And we don't even know how big this issue is. I mean, we could be talking about, you know, tens of millions of people moving. And there are a few ways that we might imagine that would happen. You might think of it in terms of immediate displacement after a terrible storm. And we're starting, we see that, for instance, let's say right after Puerto Rico, where there was the giant hurricane, and almost immediately Puerto Ricans began moving to the mainland of the United States, some temporarily, some may be there permanently, and it just sort of happened suddenly. There are other kinds of moves that we call migration, which explains people gradually moving from some areas into others. And so you have widely expanding deserts in North Africa, for instance, and people just gradually moving from those areas into cities or to areas where there's more water. And then relocation is where an actual community or a town might actually pick up and say, we want to organize ourselves and completely move. But the problem with this is we expect, as I say, millions of people over the next several, you know, decades will be moving in some way, in part because of changes in climate. But these folks will not have, under international law, what we would normally call refugee status, right? That is, in order to have a status as a refugee in the world under international law, you have to show that you are fleeing some kind of political persecution, essentially. There's no form of refugee status for fleeing environmental problems or economic problems. And so these folks will have no status, right, as refugees, and yet some of them will be moving literally because their former countries are inhabitable. You know, if you think of residents of small island nations who are literally seeing their territory swallowed up. You could imagine people who no longer have citizenship because their country no longer physically exists. So you would start to have problems where people, A, don't have citizenship anywhere or anywhere to go. We are desperately in need of some kind of a global international program that would recognize this kind of status. And we don't yet have it. What we have now are countries that are in discussions with one another on a very sort of small basis. So we have, you know, for instance, Australia is in discussion with some countries and some island nations in Southeast Asia, you know, or Pacific Island countries, you know, thinking about, well, maybe we'll have an increase of or a liberalization of immigration status in some way. But it's really not fair to ask only the Australians or only the New Zealanders, let's say, to accommodate all of the people in the Pacific. They couldn't do it, and they're not the only ones responsible. We're all responsible. You know, those of us in countries that have profited quite a bit from fossil fuel consumption over the years.
And that would certainly include the United States and Europe, and yet in the political climate of Donald Trump and the reaction in Europe to an early wave of migrants from whatever cause, it seems like climate immigration is just such a hot-button issue.
Well, that's right. And you know, although it's not a subject of the paper that we're discussing, I've done other research showing that we are in the midst of climate relocations right in the United States. In fact, there are somewhere between 12 and 15 communities in the United States that are actively looking to relocate because their areas are becoming unlivable because of climate impacts. These communities actually are all tribal communities in the United States. There's one in Louisiana on an island that's sinking slowly. There are several up in Alaska, these coastal communities whose shorelines are literally falling in because of thawing permafrost. And there are a few communities on the Olympic Peninsula in Washington State that are also trying to find ways to move because their land is slipping into the ocean.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is Dr. Robert Verchik. He's an expert in international environmental law. And we're talking about who will pay what when the climate goes seriously wrong. Robert, for the layperson, what is the Warsaw International Mechanism on Loss and Damage, and how does that fit into this discussion?
Well, there was a discussion a few years back about what would happen if we had catastrophic events from climate impacts that we couldn't avoid. And the developed countries, the industrialized countries, believed that the best way to handle, you know, let's say a catastrophic storm that might occur in Indonesia, let's say, they thought that the best way to handle that would be the way that we normally handle aid from hurricanes or from other natural disasters, which means that it's a kind of aid that the global community gives in a sort of charitable way without the legal framework of a climate convention. The small island nations and many other developing countries felt that they wanted some kind of program that was going to be better funded and that would hold richer countries accountable for having caused the problem. And they referred to this issue as loss and damage, that is, loss and damage resulting from catastrophic effects of climate change in the developing world that could not be avoided. And so they insisted that some kind of transfer of wealth be connected to what they called loss and damage within the Framework Convention on Climate Change. There was a meeting in Warsaw. There's a meeting every year among the parties of this climate convention. And in Warsaw, everyone agreed to say that we would do something to address this form of catastrophic loss and damage, but we couldn't agree on exactly how to do it. The poorer countries wanted loss and damage to include a compensation package, which would literally compensate countries that were harmed by, let's say, a mega storm, and that they would get money or other technology or aid from the richer countries. The richer countries didn't want to promise compensation. They wanted this to be more of a transfer of money and technology in order to help countries build, let's say, better seawalls or stronger buildings. But they didn't want to get into a discussion of paying for damage that had already occurred that they might be seen as liable for. And so we are left right now in that debate. The Paris Agreement actually mentions the term loss and damage, and that's a win for the developing world, because the developing world fought hard for loss and damage to be something that would be addressed in the Paris Agreement. But nobody has agreed on exactly what that transfer of wealth and technology is going to look like. The industrialized countries see this as maybe helping the developing world with insurance. The developing world is hoping that this program turns into some kind of a larger shift of finances in response to compensation for actually, you know, causing a problem. They believe that under international law, the richer countries are harming the poorer countries. And under international law, if you do something that hurts somebody else's country or causes somebody else extreme damage, you have to pay for it.
We just heard from an expert that the mean average temperature in India has already breached the 1.5 degree warming mark for 9 months of the year. And the Arctic is far, far above that safety line. James Hansen says there's another 1 degree at least hidden by air pollution. I just feel the whole Paris Agreement and the UNFCCC process is far too conservative. Am I off base?
I think that is a real concern. The answer is we don't know how much climate change we're going to be seeing, you know, in the next 50 years. The Paris Agreement commits us to keeping that increase, as you know, to 2 degrees Celsius from pre-industrial levels, and commits us to working toward getting to a limit of 1.5. But many scientists are already saying that we are not going to make a 1.5 limit, and that we would be lucky to make the 2.0 limit. I mean, that's a problem. I mean, you know, if you look at how long it takes to design these agreements, and the Paris Agreement, of course, was many years in the making. It's like, you know, I tell my students, it's like you're designing a bridge, you know, and your supervisor says, design a bridge that will hold the weight of 50 cars at once. And then the next day, your supervisor says, no, make that 100 cars. And then the next day, the supervisor says, no, make that 1,000 cars. At some point, you just have to look at your design and say, well, I'm going to go right back to the drawing board and start anew. We don't want to have to start anew with the Paris Agreement. And that, I think, is why it is so important that we try everything we can to keep our greenhouse gas emissions down. We have the technology to do it. We actually have the money to do it, but we don't have the political will. And the point of my paper and the other papers in this journal, the point is that if we don't keep these numbers down, the carbon emissions down, we're going to have to go back to the drawing board again, and we're not going to be able to come up with anything that's going to be remotely satisfying. You know, we are stuck, and we have to do the hard work, because there really isn't, you know, an alternative plan at this point.
And your paper does acknowledge that the future may be worse, and so it's hard to plan. And the second principle you put forward for handling that is not very obvious. You say, do not cannibalize resources. What do you mean by that?
The international community, the industrialized world, is already providing money for its own transition to green energy. And as I mentioned earlier, the industrialized world is already making financial transfers to the developing world in order to promote more green energy and to cope with climate impacts. When I say don't cannibalize, what I mean is now it also seems clear that the developing world, the global south as we call it, is going to need money and resources to help with relocation and migration and insurance and these other things that we've been talking about that are related to loss and damage. And we shouldn't say that, as we in the global north, oh, well, we'll just take some of the money we were going to give you for the green energy transition, and we'll just make it turn it into money for loss and damage. You can't just take money out of one fund and then put it in the other fund. You're actually going to have to increase the entire pie. That is something, of course, that is politically difficult for any country in the global north to do. But the reality is it is going to have to be done because it's either pay now or pay later. There is simply no way we're going to avoid the kinds of mass migrations that will be coming. There's no way that we're going to avoid the loss of wheat production, let's say, in Central Africa. That is going to happen. And there is no way that a country like the United States is not going to be affected by that when there are millions of people crossing borders or there are famines in foreign countries. It is not like those things don't affect us. They will affect us because those things will cause violence in some countries. They might lead to civil wars. They're going to lead to security issues all over the world. And so the only real decision that we have to make in a country like the United States is, are we going to, in an orderly and planned fashion, try to respond to those issues before they happen, or are we going to wait for all of that stuff to happen and then try to respond on the fly? It's just going to cost us more money and more security and more, you know, more confusion, all of those things. It's just going to be harder for us to respond to those issues without planning. So my message in my article and in my other research is that, you know, we have to understand that these are problems. They're really, really big and serious problems, but the only way to address them is to face them, because not facing them only makes everything much, much harder to do in the future.
So if a more realistic climate reparation system is established, who will administer the large amounts of money and who will oversee that system to reduce corruption?
Well, that's a really good question. Under the current convention framework, the UN has a few what they call facilities, that is, you know, sort of a few offices that manage the development funds right now, the climate funds. So it could be managed in that way, or it could be managed through aid that moves through the World Bank or through the International Monetary Fund, or you could see this happening from national banks of some kind, you know, whether it's the National Bank of Germany or USAID and the State Department here in the United States. You could imagine sort of a global clearinghouse system, which we've already got with through the UN, and you could also imagine sort of multi-party programs or even bilateral programs from one country to another.
What are the next steps?
Well, I think the next steps are going to involve the Paris Agreement. Right now, we have a system where each country that's a member of the Paris Agreement has submitted its own nationally determined commitments for what it will do in the next few years to address climate change. And those commitments are both commitments in terms of reducing greenhouse gases and commitments in terms of adapting their cities, their buildings, in ways that can cope with climate change. We entered a new kind of an experiment with the Paris Agreement because every country is allowed to come up with its own goals and to come up with its own commitments. And so some countries are much more aggressive on their commitments than others. But the hope is that if we put that kind of flexibility in the system, that everybody will do something. And so the next step is to see how these commitments are implemented. Every country is required to submit under the Paris Agreement, to submit their goals, and then they're required to submit information about how they are progressing. And based on that, countries will then decide, you know, how much they'll commit in the future. And countries in the developing world will, I hope, see the implementation as a way of showing that they are acting in responsible ways and might be able to get funding and transfers of technical assistance from other countries. So we're going to have to see. I mean, there are some big questions there, especially because the United States has stated that it plans on leaving the agreement, which would leave the United States without very much leverage at all in terms of what the next steps would look like. I will say, though, that there is a glimmer of hope in all of this, and the glimmer of hope has to do with how quickly the price of green energy technology has fallen over the last few years. Wind energy, for instance, is almost on par, and in some places on par with generating electricity through coal. And so regardless of what happens in international environmental law, we are going to see a move toward a greener and greener economy. We are going to see a move toward zero carbon electricity generation all over the world. And we've got major banks in the world that are, you know, including the major national bank in Germany, national banks in China, and also the World Bank, which are saying that when they make loans, that they want to look at the whole carbon cycle of the projects that they lend money for, because they understand that there is a cost to generating the carbon, you know, carbon emissions, and that's going to affect the value of the projects that they lend on. So there are going to be a number of things happening within the markets themselves that will end up tamping down on carbon emissions. No question about that. The only question is it going to happen fast enough? You know, when the Trump administration, you know, starts throwing sticks into the spokes of the wheels, it stops things and delays things. It doesn't mean the progress won't happen, but it slows it down. It's a dead-ender strategy, but delay is an important villain in this piece, and we have to go as fast as we can.
We have been talking with environmental law professor Robert R. M. Verchik. He's currently visiting the Yale Law School while on leave from his post as the Gauthier St. Martin Chair in Environmental Law at Loyola University in New Orleans. Dr. Verchik just published his article, Can Loss and Damage Carry the Load?, as the concluding paper in a series in the Philosophical Transactions of the Royal Society. You can read Robert's full article for free, and I'll put the links you need in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Robert Verchik, thank you so much for talking with us.
Well, thanks very much.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Next week, we'll hear how fracking for gas killed the safe way out. And Rob Hopkins, the co-founder of the Transition Town movement, makes a personal transition. Be sure to join in for the next global broadcast of Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.